This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I think it's safe to say that over the past few decades, we have made enormous changes and advances in the way we communicate. Information is flowing at an amazing pace in almost every aspect of life. However, there is one surprising holdout, the scientific journal.
What we basically did, we took what we publish on paper and stuck it on a screen.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation on the evolution, or lack thereof, of scientific journals. We'll also talk to an author who says summer school needs to change from a place to review and make up for failed work to a place for growth and advancement, and hear why to many students, summertime equals freedom. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The format of communicating scientific information through professional journals has evolved at a near glacial pace over the past 300 years. Although advances and information technology have dramatically altered the search for and discovery of scientific information, exploiting the exploding array of media tools now available to disseminate that information has been slow. Here to talk about the state of scientific information sharing in the digital age are John Seck, an expert in technology innovation and one of the founders of High Wire Press, and Dr. Nader Rafai, a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the editor-in-chief of the journal Clinical Chemistry. They tackled this topic in the April 2013 issue of that journal. Dr. Rafai, let's start with you. What drove you to look at the state of scientific information today?
Well, if you look back at the oldest continuously published journal in the world, and that is the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, which is started appearing in early 1665 and moved, let's say, to New England Journal or PNAS in late 1800s, you will see that the format is quite similar to papers published today. You will have the introduction, the methods, the results, and the discussion sections. You will have both the original reports and the letters to the editors. References started to appear in early 1900s, and then abstracts were born around 1970s. In 1990s, what we basically did, we took what we publish on paper and stuck it on a screen. Of course, having the paper available electronically enabled us to enjoy many features like reference linking and the ability to embed other media, such as podcasts and videos. But the actual document, the actual paper, has remained static. It does not enable the readers to tailor the presentation of information to their liking or need. And more importantly, it is not interactive. So if you contrast that to the revolution in publishing and the presentation of information in the lay press, you cannot help to wonder whether we have taken full advantage of the technological advances that are available to us.
We'll turn to John Seck now. And Mr. Seck, why do scientific journals not take advantage of technology to the same extent as the lay press?
I'd say there are really two reasons, PDFs and promotion. PDFs, we found that people rely on the PDF for reading and for storing in their own local systems. So because everybody's relying on the PDFs, we sort of go to the lowest common denominator. The PDF limits what you can do to what you can fit inside that container. So there are all sorts of wonderful things happening on the internet with news sites and media sites, but they don't fit in the PDF. So that right up there, right up front, it's a barrier to publishing. Just as Nader said, we've taken a screen capture essentially, and that's the PDF. And the second reason is promotion. Your grant review committee or your tenure committee or your hiring committee, they have to recognize what you've published as a publication just like the ones they've done. And I think this all together makes things very conservative. We're now starting to see change. So, for instance, increasingly video is part of articles that are published, and we can put the videos inside the PDFs now. We're also increasingly seeing links outside from articles to raw data sets, the actual data that the research write-up is based on. We're seeing people associating blogs and podcasts and tweets now with articles. And increasingly what we're going to be seeing is that those external things are going to be tied to the papers themselves. It'll take a year or two or three, but I think it's going to be happening.
Well, what do you think is the biggest challenge to scientific publishing today, Dr. Refai?
I think one of the biggest challenges is the proliferation of minimally important and useful articles. This unfortunate fact is really driven by and large by misguided academic criteria for promotion, which frankly favors quantity over quality. If you look at ISI, for example, the number of medical and scientific journals increased by 50% between year 2000 and 2012. And now we have almost 8,300 journals in circulation. This, of course, has been accompanied by a marked increase in total number of manuscripts. So in 2012, for example, in PubMed alone, the number of scientific articles published worldwide will surpass 1.1 million, averaging 126 articles per hour. And if you look across all disciplines and all languages, the total number of publications is estimated to be twice as high. Clearly, the open access journals and electronic format publishing have contributed greatly to this exponential growth. So if you take PLOS ONE as an example, which is the world's largest journal, it publishes over 2,000 articles a month. What is interesting, though, that according to Eugene Garfield, who is the founder of ISI, a great deal of the world's medical literature is never recognized. For example, of the 38 million articles published between 1900 and 2005, about half have never been cited a single time. Indeed, 70% of the journals that are indexed by ISI have impact factor less than 2, and 40% have impact factor less than 1. So the unfortunate thing is the researcher at the present time of abundance of information does not have an effective and an efficient way to find the relevant articles. You do a simple search using a couple of keywords, and you will get tens or hundreds of articles, most of which are not useful to you. One day, and that's hopefully soon, we will have personal robots that will know what we read, they will know what we write, so they can identify for us exactly what we need.
John, do you think that we're just going to stop publishing journals in print? And if so, when's that going to happen?
Well, let's differentiate printed issues of journals from printable articles in journals. I think that's a helpful distinction here, and the answer is different based on that distinction. First of all, the printable articles, PDFs essentially, they're not going away anytime soon. We've done enough interviews with enough researchers to know that they're wedded to the PDFs. Half the people we interviewed read the PDFs online, but half still print them out and write on them and then either file the paper away or they just discard it. But people really like that printable version. But printed issues, where you have the whole collection of articles all bundled together and put in a nice cover, those largely have gone away, except for major medical journals where there's a lot of advertising that's bound together with the print issue and is really part of the revenue that a publisher is expecting. I think there's a new option which is going to change this and has already started changing it with medical journals, but I think increasingly the basic science journals. And that's the laser printer was introduced back in, oh, I think it was the mid-80s, I think 1986. And nothing really has changed how we print out things much since then, until the tablet came along with the iPad. Now with the iPad and with the other tablets, you can really combine the a print-like reading experience where you have high-quality pages in front of you and you can turn them pretty quickly, the ability to scan. You can combine that kind of reading experience with the online advantages, like searching and linking. So I think we're going to see more of a shift away from print as more and more people start feeling comfortable with having issues delivered on their tablets rather than in their mailboxes.
John Sack is an expert in technology innovation and one of the founders of Highwire Press. And Dr. Nader Rafai is a professor of pathology at Harvard Medical School and the editor-in-chief of the journal Clinical Chemistry. You can read more about this topic in the April 2013 issue of that journal. Still to come, summer school shouldn't just be for slackers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if there are any programs you missed or would like to hear again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own T-Book archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1192. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. According to our next guest, the educational system in the U.S. is wasting 2.5 perfectly good months by going on vacation. Yovel Badash is the author of No Child Held Back. We spoke recently about the current state of summer school and how he sees that time being used in the future.
I believe the whole concept of school and when is learning happening and what's the purpose is changing. The summer school is part of it. It's an indication of a broader change that is happening right now.
What's happening that's changing?
So I think there's a couple of things that are happening. One is that schools realize that they have a big challenge. They need to do a lot, like, you know, change their curriculum with Common Core standards, get their teachers updated with the latest evaluation frameworks. They need to comply with different requirements through the waiver of No Child Left Behind. They have a lot of stuff going on, and they realize that, you know, the traditional structure, the traditional kind of brick-and-mortar classroom experience doesn't have, like, a huge growth ahead of it. You realize that, you know, learning can happen at home, like flipped classroom. You realize that learning can happen online with blended learning. So it's kind of like the whole perspective about learning and about what schools are and when really kids catch up is really changing. The summer vacation originally came from agriculture, working at home, where today we don't have that many families need their kids to help in the field. And learning is something that happens all the time and should happen all the time. So the concept of the summer school being remedial work can be expanded now to do other things as well.
With so many communities having trouble with budgets, do you see this as something that can spread as quickly as you think it might have to?
I think budgets are tight, and like anything, that if the budget is a problem, then there could be a solution that would address that. The solutions could be virtual programs over the summer. They could be blended programs where you don't really need a teacher. The biggest cost in our system is really manpower. That's really where the bulk of the budget goes to. If you could do more with less, if you can get great instruction from the Khan Academy or the likes, or, you know, YouTube or other content providers, and provide a blended experience or create a way for kids to get remedial work without the need for 1-to-1 or 1-to-10 teacher-to-student, then you could do more. I mean, I'm not saying it'll happen overnight, but it's definitely the direction, I think.
What types of things would the summertime be used for, or do you see it being used for in some of the, I hear it's being used in some of the largest school districts in the country now. What is it being used for kids to just get a little bit ahead, or to just do some work that really wouldn't be available to them if they just stuck to a four-year high school, say?
I think it will be both, and it will be other things as well. The summer is considered in education to be like the new year. It's kind of like a lot of times during the summer you have New Year resolution. Those that have been behind through the traditional timing can now catch up. Those that were held back and want to do a little bit more can actually do more. The school in general can prepare for the new year. A lot of things are changing. We have Common Core that is now relevant. We have PARC assessments that are relevant to standardized testing and other things that are changing. We have new evaluation frameworks that are implemented. So all of these changes, you know, need to be communicated, need to be addressed. There's regulations and mandates that are out there that schools need to comply. So the summer is a great time for preparation. It would be relevant to students as well in the same way. And I think students could use this time where it's not really the traditional classroom, like, you know, 8 to 3 traditional timing, to really explore, taste something new, catch up on things that they had difficulties with, and in general kind of get ready for the new year.
Could schools also be using this time, since they need to innovate, be using this to, well, test new innovations that might be used for the rest of the school year?
They could, and some do, but it's a little bit difficult when people are not completely 100%, you know, engaged. So you have a lot of people that are on vacation. You have a lot of activities of, like, you know, team meetings or team building activities like professional development. I mean, I hope that that will change. So like you said, summer will be used for a lot more for innovation, trying new things, you know, where the cameras are off in a way. When the summer is here, like, it, you have a way to experiment more, but it's going to be hard because of the traditional, at least for the behavioral patterns, most people, you know, are taking a couple weeks off, and they're, you know, like, things are a lot more quiet over the summer. I do hope that innovation will be part of it, but I'm not sure it'll happen that quick.
Every year or so, we hear a story about this school district or this city going or contemplating going to a year-round educational system. Is it going to happen, say, 5 years down the road that, you know, summer vacation will just be something that we get nostalgic about?
I believe so. I don't know if it's really the school year. I think it might be actually what schools are. What are they? Not only the school year will change, but what the teacher is. And 5 years from now, which is really eternity in perspective of technology or innovation. So absolutely, the reality is going to change. We're going to have a lot more digital education happening. We're going to have learning at your term. So, you know, kids potentially could learn year-round. I think the whole concept of a school is going to change. The role of a teacher is going to change. We're going to go through a lot of exciting things in education. Now, it might not be completely changed on all aspects, but there is no question that there is a shift, and the shift is accelerating.
Again, the name of Yovel Badash's book is No Child Held Back. You can read more at nochildheldback.com.
You need to go to summer school. Get to the beach or at least in the pool. Time to go to summer school.
While the summer months may be used more productively in the future, it will be a hard sell to commentator Audrey Summers. And that's not just because of her name. To her, summer means freedom.
Summer. The human population values a season over any other. Most students would even consider summer the most beloved time of year. They relish it. They celebrate it. They even skip school to enjoy its earliest days. But some may ask why. The answer is simple. The answer is freedom. For a few short, fleeting months, I am tied down by nothing. No school, no sports, no early mornings. I pick and choose what my day consists of. So why fill up the summer with working a job, taking extra classes, and training for sports? That's a good question. Well, we do love summer because we aren't tied down by academics and extracurricular activities. But I believe that summer can be about deciding how to use that freedom. During the school year, we're told what to learn and when to learn it. Don't you ever remember sitting in a classroom wondering what your teacher is actually trying to say? But during the summer, I choose what to fill my mind with. Whatever my interests are, whether sitting on a deck reading a book, hanging out with friends, or going for a run, I decide how much I pursue them and what the outcome will be. That being said, subjects that don't appeal to me, such as quadratic equations, Spanish verbs, and the solubility of salts, are pushed out of my mind until school rolls around in September. Many high school students work in the summer. I think this has less to do with how we use our freedom and more to do with necessity. The closest place to actually go out and have a night on the town is 2 hours away. This means students end up spending most of their money on gas. Many teenagers also need money for the future. Most of the time, moving hundreds of miles away to go to college is expensive. But there's another reason we cherish summer. This time of year means less pressure. During the summertime, it feels like we're being judged less by others. I don't know if you remember, but in school, sometimes there's days where we obsess over whether our clothes look right or if our hair is cooperating. Come June, nobody has to be in a building with 100 other people and worry what they think. We pick who we see every day, and we can act whichever way we want. So I guess summer feels like a magical part of the year. I'm given a large dose of freedom, and most of the pressure evaporates away. I know that a lot of you work and hustle all summer, and I'll get there eventually. But for me, right now, summer is a reprieve from everyday life.
This commentary from Audrey Summers comes to us from WTIP North Shore Community Radio, online at WTIP.org.
Summer's here. I'm for that.
Well, while we're already on the topic of summer, let's talk about two things you're likely to see this time of year: weeds and monarch butterflies. Believe it or not, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I am Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. We go to great lengths to eliminate weeds from our gardens and yards. But as Ernest Williams, the William R. Keenan Professor of Biology at Hamilton College, explains, the widespread elimination of weeds is undermining an iconic insect species.
The storied mass migration of monarch butterflies is remarkable and well known. In the fall, they fly from their breeding range in the eastern United States and Canada to overwintering sites in the mountains of central Mexico, and then fly back the next spring. Grim news about monarchs has reached the airwaves recently, however. Their abundance shows a significant downward trend, and measurements during the winter of 2012-13 revealed the fewest overwintering monarchs ever recorded. The monarch story illustrates how humans are altering the landscape in ways that harm other species. Monarchs fly back each summer because of the abundant growth of milkweeds in the central U.S. and southern Canada. These are the only plants they lay their eggs on, but expanded planting of corn and soybean crops, genetically modified to tolerate herbicides, has resulted in increased use of these chemicals, and as a result, milkweeds are disappearing throughout the agricultural areas of the Midwest. Monarchs are also losing their overwintering habitat. Descended from tropical ancestors, they cannot survive freezing, but they find just the right climatic conditions to survive the winter in the high-elevation forests of central Mexico. There they congregate densely on fir trees. However, logging has thinned the insulating capacity of the forest canopy, increasing the risk of their freezing. Monarchs are unique in their endangered migration across three countries. Just imagine a butterfly that weighs only as much as a paperclip can fly more than 2,000 miles to pass the winter away from freezing storms, and then its descendants fly back the next year to repopulate most of eastern North America. For this phenomenon to continue, people must protect the fir forests on Mexican mountains and plant and maintain milkweed patches in the summer breeding range.
That was Ernest Williams of Hamilton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.